You're listening to episode 87 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang. Whoa, I cannot believe we're one episode away from our 88th episode.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what is up, Storyteller Tribe? I wanted to thank BookCon for sponsoring today's episode. BookCon is the ultimate celebration of books where your favorite stories come to life, and it's all happening on June 3rd and 4th at the Javits Center in New York City. Hang around at the end of the show to find out more about BookCon. I also wanted to take a moment to thank all of you for being so incredibly supportive of our show. I appreciate each and every one of you for joining us on a weekly basis. And if you just found our show, a warm welcome to our tribe. And I encourage you to head over to 88cupsoftea.com/archive to browse through our library of episodes. A huge hug for our amazing listeners who recommended and shared our podcast with friends and left incredibly touching iTunes reviews. Our most recent iTunes review was left by username BridgeWritesYA, who gave us 5 stars and wrote, "Love this podcast." Continued to write, "This is a diamond in the rough of podcasts. Very informative and always has an author on that I want to know more about anyway. I had a moment in the Anne Bruchara's interview where I realized we share the same favorite Judy Blume book. Yin does everything right and executes each podcast flawlessly. Love, 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 love." Thank you so much for taking the time to leave that amazing review. We do work really hard and put a lot of heart into producing this show, so you have no idea how happy I am to know that you appreciate our efforts. Thank you. Thank you. On to the next part of our show. Be sure to join our private Facebook group. It's the perfect place for you to be if you're looking for a loving community to hang out with fellow storytellers and to check in with each other about your work in progress. Our group is filled with support and encouragement, and we also post threads where you can submit your listener questions for upcoming interviews with really cool guests. We just recently started recording live Facebook videos that's exclusive only for our members in the private group. We're talking about book hauls and unboxing videos, and sometimes I'll even record videos where I'll chat with members in our group while I prepare dinner. So be sure to come over and hang out with us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. You'll feel right at home, and I'm so excited to meet you in there. That's facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. One more thing before I introduce today's guest. This week we have 2 listener birthday shoutouts. A very happy birthday to Haley Reed and Nadine Gonzalez. I hope you ladies have the best time celebrating your special day and may all your dreams and wishes come true. Now on to our show. I am so excited to share this week's new episode featuring Victoria V.E. Schwab, one of our most requested guests for the show and the number one New York Times bestselling author of 12 books. Most of you know Victoria from the Shades of Magic series, where an Entertainment Weekly article describes her writing as addictive and immersive. In Victoria's episode, we cover a whole lot about life and non-writing related topics, including sexuality and tea, the fear of speaking, serial killers, etiquette camp, and S-Town. We, of course, discuss the creative process as well. I immediately clicked with Victoria and had the best time chatting away for over 3 hours. It was a pretty difficult process for our co-producer, Moonlin, having to edit it down to 1.5 hours and present it to you in a more bite-sized format. So we really hope you enjoy the final edited version. A bit more about what we cover in the writing-related topics, we discuss why it's crucial to create as few parameters as possible around your writing, and how working with a flexible schedule and freeing yourself from a strict writing place helps with creative flow. Victoria breaks down how she's able to read 100 books a year, and you'll be able to apply her tips to your own habits to up your reading game, many of which I'll be applying for myself as well. We touch on reading different genres and styles of writing and how that helps to strengthen your writing. For my craft-focused listeners, this episode is a dream. We unpack the differences in writing multiple genres, writing morally ambiguous characters, discovering the voices of your characters, and writing multiple points of views, and we dive into writing query letters. I am so excited to finally share this episode with you, so let's jump right in.
Hey everyone, you guys are going to be so excited. We have V.E. Schwab on our show. I know a lot of you are super pumped about this. I've never seen so many of you popping up in our Facebook group, asking questions and being so involved and talking about what huge fans you are and how supportive you are of Victoria's work and how much it's impacted you with your own writing journey. I was excited before, but now I'm even more excited just to know how enthusiastic everybody is. Victoria, how are you?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me on the program.
We already had a little bit of a chat before, and Victoria is a really awesome human being.
We've already bonded.
We bonded, girl. We bonded over some real important topics. Right. Let's talk about, where are you calling in from?
Nashville, Tennessee, which is my U.S. base. I split my time between, and it's going to sound so much more pretentious than it is. I split my time between Nashville, Tennessee, Edinburgh, Scotland, and a tiny cottage in the French countryside.
That is amazing. How did this come up?
I grew up in Tennessee, in Nashville. I'm actually originally from California, but I'm from north of where you are. I'm from the Bay Area. And
oh, wow.
I was raised in the South, went to an all-girls Southern prep school, as you do, then went off and got my degree, and then went off a couple years later and got a graduate degree in Scotland, fell in love with Edinburgh, and have been spending more and more time there. It's just where I leave my bones at the end of the day. My heart is so happy there. And then my parents up and retired. I'm an only child, so I'm close with my parents. They up and retired and bought a 500-year-old cottage in the French countryside and just peaced out before the election. They were like, bye. I go over two or three times a year and then split my time over there between their house. That's where my pets live. It's got like walled gardens and prison cells underneath the garden walls and things.
God.
My heart home, and then Scotland. And then when I'm in the States, when I'm not touring, I did like 85 events last year, so I'm trying to do fewer this year. I live in a weird little apartment in Nashville with 20-foot long bookshelves that are organized by color and a very fat house cat named Oliver.
Who takes care of your pets when you're traveling everywhere?
Okay, this is the best part, right? I have friends who work at a local bookstore who come over and they house sit and they take care of Oliver, and my cat loves them far more than he loves me.
That is hilarious.
Every time they come over, they bring him new toys. So every time I come back from a trip, he has stuffed like catnip mice and toys and games. And I'm like, are you serious? This cat is living a better life than I am.
The cat is basically trained to not love you anymore.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about this.
Everyone's spoiling him.
You have an amazing community of friends. I have never heard of this before, having friends that you make at a bookstore come over and take care of your baby.
I'm very lucky in that I got this apartment. It was my very first adulthood move. I bought this apartment. It's really pretty. I renovated the entire thing, and it's in one of the hip areas in Nashville. So it's walking distance coffee shops and bakeries and all these things. So basically they just like come and they stay in my apartment and look after my cat, and they just can have like all the books that they want, and there's food around.
It really sounds like a co-working space as well.
Friends in New York that do it.
Yeah, it's a big thing. I'm really digging it because my girlfriend, she was wanting to do this co-working mastermind group because we used to live in downtown LA, and it's freaking gorgeous. And you're just like overlooking the skyline of LA, although there's not much of a skyline, to be really biased, because I'm from New York. My friend was like, oh, where's the skyline? I'm like, yeah, there is none. Looks like Legos. Come on, girl, you've been to New York. You know,
there's only one real skyline in this country.
I remember my girlfriend wanting to gather all her friends and just have them there and just to work, even if they're not in a mastermind session talking about business. She wanted a space for them to come together and feel productive, because when you're in that environment and you look out and you see city buildings, your mind is very a New York minute. You're going a mile a minute and you're thinking of ideas and how to grow what it is, your business, whatever business you're doing. And she wanted to create something like that. And when I was looking more into it, I realized how big of a movement this whole co-working space has been, especially the last, what, 2 years?
For artists. One, it works for me because I'm super competitive. And if I see other people working, I'm likely to stick around. Plus, if you have to pay for it, then you're paying for it. You're investing in your own art and craft. You're far less likely to just watch Netflix. Self-discipline, it can be really hard, depending on how your emotional state is at the time, your headspace. And so having whatever people need to do, there is no right way.
I absolutely agree.
Be alone in the sensory deprivation chamber. And other people need to be surrounded by people. So my needs change depending on the day and the project. it's okay to be changeable. This idea that we have to like figure out what works and then keep doing it. Our moods, especially with art, you got to do whatever it is that works. And what works on one day does not have to be the thing that works on the next day.
I do love to ask, how do you do your work? What works for you? What doesn't?
It depends on which book I'm writing, and I'll find the right environment for one book. It's not the right environment for another one because I write children's books, YA and adult, and I just have different headspace needs. And sometimes I need to be able to read my work aloud. And so if I know I'm working on a project where in order to find the flow, I have to read the sentences back to myself aloud, then I'm not going to work in public because then it gets real fast. I do have one piece of advice for any listeners, and that's create as few parameters as you can. When I talk to writers and they're like, oh, well, I only like to write between the hours of 9 and 11 a.m. with a cup of chamomile tea, and it has to be in a very specific mug, and the sunlight has to be coming through the window. I'm like, what you're doing is you're giving yourself an excuse to write. Right? The more parameters you have, like the more easier it is for you to be like, oh no, I can't.
That is a really freaking good point.
So much of what we do is trying to find excuses not to do it because it would be easier not to. I'll have days where if I tell myself, oh, I only like to write in the mornings, and then it suddenly gets to be like 2 p.m, I'm like, well, I might as well not start writing today because it's just not enough time left.
I've never actually seen it that way. And thank you for giving me that eye-opening awareness. Most of the writers that we've talked to, they're really good and very disciplined, and I'm not one of those.
I write ebooks a year and I still dick around on Netflix the vast majority of the time. I'm not lazy. I actually have like a really big issue with this idea of writers being people that sit around 9/10 of the time. That always bothers me. How are you affording to do any of that? No one has an efficacy of 100%. You have to rebuild everything that you're tearing down. If you're a marathon runner, running a marathon actually like destroys muscle, but then you have to take time to rebuild. And creativity does the same thing. Creative output takes a toll that then you have to compensate with creative input. I'm a firm believer in refilling the creative wells. I totally believe anyone is lying. Unless you're, I think John Scalzi is the only person I've spoken to where I genuinely believe that he writes 2,000 words every single morning. But if you're not John Scalzi, I don't believe it.
I need to know also about this creative well. I love the way you said that.
For me, when I say creative well, I actually mean input of new content. For me, filling the creative well means reading books, watching movies, reading comics, listening to music, like doing anything to replenish the creative calories, so to speak. And so, but for me, I have two different primary places that I work. One is at my kitchen table because I have these bookshelves. I get a lot of shit for these bookshelves, which I'm always these bookshelves are huge and they're beautiful and they're the whole reason I have this apartment, but they're color coordinated. They're a rainbow and it makes me so happy. And the thing is, people have to understand, is one, I almost never reread, but I have a library complex. So I need to own the books, but I probably won't reread them. And so books become a piece of art for me. That's why the books are arranged that way. People are always like, well, how do you find it? One, because I'm probably not going to need it in short order. But also I have a visual memory. I originally went to art school. Like I can find the book. I put them there. I know where they are. But I like it because I'm working at my table and it's that kind of very close proximity to what I'm working toward. I have these shelves filled with books. Everything that I do is to making space on that shelf for my book. And honestly, if we're being real, for feeding my book buying habit, which is its own problem. So for me, I'm incredibly inspired by just sitting at the kitchen table. Plus in like a really weird, super, I don't know whether to call this consumerist or Slytherin. I don't know. You could approach it from so many different directions, but I bought this apartment with money that I earned writing books. And so sitting at the kitchen table, surrounded by things that I bought and paid for with book money, is kind of very motivating.
Yeah, it is. It's a full circle.
Sorry, my cat just got like stuck to a chair.
Oh my God, that's so cute.
Could not disentangle him.
Is he fat?
He's large. He's not fat. He's like a tiny lion.
Girl, you gotta get him fat. I love fat cats.
He's tubby. He's not like a Scottish fold or one of those cats where you're just like, you're spherical. But no, sorry, just if you heard a scratching noise in the background, that was my cat literally trying to detach himself from a chair.
Oh, please. We know he just wanted a cameo appearance.
Oh, yeah. He's just obnoxious. You can find my cat on my Instagram. I'm pretty sure he's more popular than I am at this point. So the other place that I love to write is this coffee shop downtown. And I love it because I'm convinced it's my actual room of requirement. My room of requirement came out of my head and made a coffee shop because it's got these high cathedral-like ceilings and it plays classical music and it's quiet and it's a grad student hangout. And I write most of my adult genre books there.
That sounds beautiful. Do you share photos of your spaces, whether it's the coffee shop, your own apartment, or the cottage?
My apartment, because I'm super proud of it. So it's mostly whenever I can't think of anything else to post on Instagram. Here, have my bookshelves.
I'm that crazy person who spends hours on end on Pinterest because it's so freaking addicting. I love looking at libraries.
Okay, number one. You have to go onto my Instagram.
Oh, girl. Okay, I'm probably going to get a book boner.
Oh, it's powerful.
Okay, I better get my lotion, my tissue ready. Excuse me.
Do whatever you need to do. Okay. Every time I post pictures, people are like, tag your porn. One of my favorite internet sites.
That's my favorite kind of porn. And the thing is, I also love looking at writing nooks where people post these gorgeous photos of all white background and all white furniture.
If my parents' tiny French cottage couldn't get any better, because I'm an only child, they obviously made a bedroom in it for me. And they've got these massive beams because they're like 500-year-old beams. Basically, each beam is a tree, right? And in my bedroom, there is a corner behind one of the beams where they built like a reading nook with cushions and built-in bookshelves on this tiny little nook and a Neil Gaiman quote on the wall and everything.
I'm pretty jealous right now, but in the best way possible.
I had to say it.
Do you have photos of that posted on Instagram?
Yeah, there's one photo of it. It's hidden behind a giant French beam.
That's amazing. I always love to look for inspiration too, because I'm like, all right, for our next place, me and my girlfriend are temporarily living in San Diego before going back to LA once she opens up her restaurant shop. So when that opens, we have to look for a place in that same town.
See, you did the smartest thing. You got to find a girlfriend who is also a chef. You're my third friend who is dating a girl who cooks. This is what is wrong with my life right now, is I need a girlfriend who cooks.
Don't worry, I can introduce you to plenty of them. Don't even worry about that.
I need you guys to move to LA and then I'll come to LA and then you introduce me to gay girls who cook, because that's what I need.
Done and done. We have a whole circle of them. Don't even worry about it. Perfect. I hope you're into Asian people, because let me tell you, they know how to cook.
Like, the things I should not be talking about on a podcast. I am very much into Asian girls. I feel like it's a super weird thing, because if I were a white guy, I would just smack myself just for saying it. But I can't help it, okay? I can't help it.
Listen, it's okay.
I'm spending a lot more time in LA too, because I'm doing a lot of movie meetings. So I'm telling you, let me know when you guys move to LA.
Done and done. And she loves doing dinner gatherings.
Oh,
she brings people together, acquaintances, strangers, yeah, whoever wants to join. It's a supper club. And
oh my God, I love everything about this.
Yeah, right, she wants heart. She was born and raised in San Diego. So they're all about heart and conversation and hi, how are you? And coffee shop baristas remembering your name and your children's names and saying hi to you every day. She went up to the Bay Area to help start a bar, because I know you're from the Bay Area, but yeah, it was specifically San Jose.
Oh, that's where I grew up.
Yeah. Get the hell out of here.
I grew up in Campbell, which is, it's the suburb of San Jose.
Have you gone back recently?
No.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you, maybe you might know some shops that popped up. I'm like, maybe you've gone in and visited the bar.
That's so crazy. Because I say Bay Area because nobody ever knows San Jose. All the listeners are like, congratulations, you're gay. Can we talk about books now? And I'm like the queer scene in Nashville is just not great.
To be honest, there are some things with all the news happening, especially after the election. And it's unfortunate where I have friends that are like, oh my God, come out to this certain place and blah, blah, blah. But I'm like, yeah, it sounds beautiful, but I'm scared shitless. Number one, I'm Asian. I went to Florida with my family. We were just visiting and checking it out. Five of us crossing the street. Some people call us chinks. And no joke, serious? The N-word, calling us Asians the N-word. And then we're like, wait.
Ignorant as I'm, well as racist. Right. Like,
that was a rude fucking awakening.
Nashville is a blue dot in the middle of a red state. So I had like a dating app on my phone. And then I was out in LA and all of a sudden, all of the girls on my dating app were like super hot.
You're like, damn, I should have got an apartment here.
Right? You go back home. These people are now 1,500 miles away. And you're like, oh, shit.
My girlfriend right now was the first woman I've been with. And for her, she's been with women before. And she did say, girl, you have no idea. Like, it was hard. It was totally hard.
I'm fairly femme. My aspirations are like Tilda Swinton meets David Bowie. I'm like, femme. Oh, but like, fun. I want to wear all black suits, you know? Like a sexy, slightly masculine, androgynous style, right? But like, yes, very clearly femme. I also like femme. A lot of femme gay girls, they love the more masculine girls and the butch girls. That's fine. Whatever suits you. But it's hard because it's hard to find a femme who likes other femmes. I'm then not most fem girls type.
You know, joke, like my girlfriend was saying the same thing. It was really difficult for her.
How did you guys meet?
She helped to start this delicious restaurant in Silver Lake in Los Angeles. One of my best friends who used to live in Silver Lake before moving out to Venice, she was like, I'm so into Taiwanese oolong tea right now. I'm like, all right. And then she's like, so there's this new restaurant that just opened a block down from my home. Let's go check it out. She shows me the Yelp photos. I'm like, girl, this is not owned by authentic Taiwanese people. We went in. Sure enough, it was Taiwanese. The first one I meet there is Moonlin. And she's there at the front holding it down. And she's like, hi, nice to meet you. At that moment, I did not know that I was into women. I was actually out of a relationship with a guy before that. Uh-huh. I used to make jokes with that guy. And I was like, you know what? What happens if we ever break up? And it was so weird. It's not something that I would say. So it's like as if my subconscious knew. And then I was like, what if I end up dating a woman? He's a sweet guy. He was very Catholic too. Yeah. And he was like, no. He was just so offended and upset and angry as if I insulted him.
Then they're afraid they turned you gay somehow. Oh, none of this shit is binary.
Yep, exactly. Thank you. So that time I was out of that relationship, thank goodness. But it was weird because that same best friend of mine who brought me to that restaurant, she set me up on one of those dating sites. It was so bizarre. She's like, should I put you as interested in women and men or just men? And I was like, wait, excuse me? What are you talking about? I didn't even realize then. So I was like, of course, men. What are you saying? She's like, you know, listen, just letting you know, it's okay. There's no judgment and no one should be judging and it's not an issue at all.
She knew even before you knew.
She outed me before I knew myself. And then after that, so I met Moonlin at that restaurant a month after my best friend set me up on that online dating. Well, I met Moonlin and it was literally just as a friend. And I was like, okay, cool. She's a cool chick. If anything, I felt worried that my best friend was going to replace me with this new awesome hot looking Asian lady. So it's pretty funny how that dynamic started. Then me and my bestie went to Burning Man 3 months after that first meeting with Moonlin. Moonlin coincidentally was going to Burning Man as well. And we found this out about a month before Burning Man was happening. So this is like over 2.5 years ago. What happened was Moonlin was like, hey, so me and my friends are going to Burning Man. I know you guys are newbies. And she's like a 3-4 time burner. And she's like, if you need help, we're here. We can save a plot of land for you next to us. We can guide you and show you around. If you need any help, we have your back. And I'm like, eh, we don't need your help. It's fine. And then of course, my best friend is like, oh no, we need her help. So then we end up plotting ourselves right next to them and setting up tent. And girl, one day we just all went partying. One of the evenings, it was almost towards the end of Burning Man. Yeah. Holy shit. My best friend and her boyfriend left me. They fell asleep at 10 p.m. I drank so much black tea. I swear to you, like Moonlin and their friends thought I was on drugs and thought the word black tea was a code word for a drug.
Like, no, I literally am just like,
I'm probably the prudish person ever. I literally am so not on drugs right now. It's literally black tea. They're like, sure, whatever. Yeah, that's cool. I'm like, really? And then so that night on all that black tea, I was up all night dancing throughout the night with Moonlin and her group, even though I wasn't that tight with her. And all of a sudden I like looked over and I saw some girls walking up to her and talking. Uh-huh. And I realized I got jealous, completely jealous. I'm like, holy fucking shit. I'm like, why am I having these feelings right now? Like, this is so weird. So I came out to myself at Burning Man.
That's amazing.
I was fucking scared. You know that Burning Man has absolutely no reception.
Yeah.
One of my other best friends, this guy, he's gay, and I needed to talk to him about his experience. And I was late 20s. At that age, I should know my sexuality.
Society is full of coding, though. I went to an all-girls prep school, so I already was 4 years late. It was drilled into me that that is not a thing that you do.
That was for me, too. I grew up in this area in Long Island where gay people were not acknowledged. It wasn't even talked about. I did not know about gay people till I was outside of high school, believe it or not.
There's your delay right there.
It's true. So me and Moonlin, we realized we're both bisexual. And the thing is, you love who you love. I don't see gender and I don't like categories. I don't like labels. It's just easier for people to throw you in labels.
Well, for the longest time, I didn't come out. So I'm bi. I mean, I always say I get gayer by the day. I hate labels. And I am a firm believer of love first, gender second. For me, I resisted it for such a long period of time. And I still don't really like the label. I hate the whole idea of labels. I'm like, but I don't need it. So why does it matter? But yeah, I'm amazed by, I'm very lucky. I have like very, very good lesbian friends in my life. But there's a whole bunch of lesbian women or girls who will not date me because I'm bi.
I just don't understand that. That's the thing that Moonlin was telling me about, because she's been in the scene way longer than I have. And I never had a proper chance of being in the dating world when I did come out to myself, yeah, because immediately you hear the term U-Haul lesbian. I mean, hello, it became true for us. I mean, like, we were U-Hauling, like, holy shit, girl. I was like, what does that mean? I'm like, oh, that means us. Okay. When she was telling me that, I was like, what on earth? Why create more divisions?
So I had like a really long conversation with a couple of my closest gay friends, and I brought it up. Obviously, I think I lean more these days towards gay than straight, but I talked to them, and I think it's because they, in my friend's eyes, if you're bi, you have the option to pass then. Like, you can make life easy for yourself by choosing to be with men still and still feel some modicum of wholeness, though it doesn't work that way because it's falling in love with a person. You don't just get to be like, no, I only look for men. That's not how it works. For them, they had no choice. In their mind, bisexuality was still a kind of choice. If you're bi and you choose to go the faux heterosexual route, then you can still have the normal life without prejudice. Whereas for lesbians, there is no choice there. In their mind, it's like you have a 50-50 chance of having a normal life. I totally get that. There is a hierarchy of disenfranchisement there. But at the same time, it's a false equivalency to think that this is just a 50-50 kind of thing.
I can understand that. And I do feel the same way. But it doesn't mean that we can just switch it off. We talk about marriage, we talk about kids in the future and all that stuff.
It's your with. It's who you're with right now.
Exactly.
That matters.
Thank you very much. If we were only looking at what we're seeing today, right now, then that means my pool is smaller.
Yeah. It's not like you're going to break up with Moonlin just so that you can have a quote unquote normal life. Then they're saying if you're bisexual and you're with a woman, then your only option then in order to have that kind of freedom that a lot of, I guess, like the gay community thinks you have is to legit like no longer be with the person that you're in love with and force yourself into a specific lane. I understand where it comes from. I feel like I have less room to judge. I've not been out my whole life. This is a thing that I repressed for long enough that it's not something I dealt with in my early teen years, not consciously. I dealt with it unsubconsciously, but I don't know. It's a messy, messy thing.
Is your family, are they like totally cool with it?
Yeah. So I came out over the course of like 10 years repeatedly to my parents. I think my parents are wonderfully supportive about everything in my life. They want me to be happy. I think they're 100% supportive in theory and 80 to 90% supportive in actuality, which I just think is just, you know, they want me to have a stable, happy life. It got easier when I basically explained to them, yo, these loins are not reproducing either way. So if you're holding out because you think I'm going to bring you a grandchild of my womb, sorry. If you want me to be with a man because you want me to have like a nuclear family with a man and a woman and a child, you're not going to get that either way. So if you can put that aside, they want me to have the easiest life. They don't want me to go through more difficulty. No parent wishes that on their child. And so in that way, I think that's their only major reservation. I'm an only child. They don't have a choice here.
Yes, yes.
Like, well, we have other children.
Right? It's like, all right, we can lose one.
I'm fairly headstrong. So I think that they knew they were never going to disown me. This was never a risk of me being kicked out of the house. There was never a risk of my parents being, I can't look at you. It's simply them coming to terms with the idea of their child being put in any kind of situation where they're discriminated against. Obviously, I come from high privilege environment. I'm white. And I'm upper middle class, right? Historically Jewish. That's the only way that they know how to contextualize things. My family's on both sides is Jewish. And so they know that's the only kind of discrimination that they can relate to. But really, in every other way, I have privilege my whole life and they have had privilege. They simply don't want my life to be harder than it has to be.
That was similar to my parents. My mom, she thought I was kidding. Kind of like a similar situation. We're like, but no, really. And she's like, how do you know? I'm like, she's like, well, I love boobs too. I'm like,
that was like, I kissed a girl in college. I'm like, mom, like literally none of this means the same thing. I was 16 when I said it jokingly the first time. And my father said, and I quote, as long as she's pretty. And of course I'm 16 and I look at my father and I'm like, dad, of course she'd be pretty.
That is amazing. Oh my God. I bet he's like, I taught you well.
Podcasts. And one of the podcasts is just talking about gay girls. And the other podcast is talking about books.
Oh my God. I love this. I think the biggest thing that I have is being around friends who are gay and having to feel they still have to pretend to live a certain life or a lifestyle. And that's not cool with me. And I know it's not fair of me to be interjecting into their life and be like, no, you need to come out now. I'm not trying to do that, but it's more so...
It just makes me sad.
Exactly. It pains me to see them in pain because they can't accept who they really are.
I had a couple of friends who got married, and my friend, her parents wouldn't come to the wedding. And we flew out to Colorado, and my father walked her down the aisle. And all I could think is, well, one, I was like, Dad, enjoy that. It's probably the only time that's going to happen. I was like, this is so sad. You have to believe that her family's going to look back on that and regret that severely. It's so short-sighted. Family is family. And it saddens me. It makes me feel incredibly, again, privileged to like have parents who would not disown me, even if they disapprove. I mean, it's not their ideal situation, but I'm also an author, probably not their ideal profession. I like went to school originally for astrophysics, right?
Holy shit. Wait, what?
Yeah, I originally went to school, started out for astrophysics.
What got you into that?
All through high school, massive math science geek, really, really good at math and science, specifically physics. Got to college, started studying astrophysics, and then I realized that the course catalog was 350 pages long and life was short. And so I started bouncing around to different things, changed my major 6 times. And finally, my parents were like, dear God, child, just graduate. You're not going to any of these things, obviously.
And dear God, child, if you want to be with a woman, you can be with a woman as long as you graduate by now, okay?
We're so used to just being fine, Victoria.
Whatever you want to do.
As long as we're not having to pay for it anymore.
That is amazing leverage right there. That's freaking awesome.
Well, but there are so many people that don't have their shit together by age 30 that I feel my parents aren't in a position to complain because I'm financially solvent and all of these things. At the end of the day, you guys are doing pretty well.
Yes, exactly. And at the end of the day, you're not hurting anybody. That's the main point I brought up to my mom after she realized I was not joking around. And she's like, how could you do this to your family?
Oh, for God's sakes. I'm sorry. I hate that.
And I literally hung up. I was crying. And then I texted her this fucking long ass novel. And the main key was to drive home was that I am not hurting anybody. Moonlight is not hurting anybody.
Happiness does not hurt another person. This is not a zero sum game.
Exactly. And then in the end, my little sister, she chose a wrong sibling to mess with, ripped my mom a new asshole good. And totally.
I'm sorry for your mom, but like, good.
I swear to you, and my middle sister is even more aggressive. Oh my God, especially when it comes to human rights situations. You do not want to fuck with these two. They are so scary. And they're literally, we're like, how could you treat her like this? That means you don't love us as daughters. If you don't love her, that means you don't love us. You know what? How could you do this? Blah, 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 blah. And my baby sister was like, Mom, you know that her loving a woman has nothing to do with anything. It's just like you loving dark chocolate over milk chocolate. What's the difference? It's chocolate.
And you're like, well, one, first of all, please don't reduce this to chocolate, though I do love chocolate.
But you know what? In the end, my mom understood in terms of chocolate because chocolate is her weakness.
Chocolate is universal.
It is. And holy shit, chocolate saved our relationship. And ever since literally the next day, she called and apologized and was like, honey, tell me about Moonlin. I can't wait to hear. And I was like, whoa.
Sometimes it's just that it's that eye-opening experience. But I mean, really, that question is at the heart of so much of the anti-LGBTQ movement, in that this idea of somehow by you being with someone that you love,
somehow you being happy is going to end the world.
Yeah. And you're like, since when is this about anybody's business but yours, mm-hmm. you know?
Yep.
So what? We won't go up with the rapture. I'm so sorry. You will go up without us. Can I ask a question? But it's kind of personal. But I feel like this whole last past hour is just us being like... What's the cultural element to it? Because you're Taiwanese.
Yes. So my dad's Taiwanese. My mom is Chinese, Malaysian, and Singaporean. I am very lucky and I feel very privileged as well. I mean, I hate to say this, but I hate to use the word lucky, but in a way I feel lucky. Do you know what I'm saying? I feel like you shouldn't have to use the word lucky in a situation like this, but I do, in that hearing about other coming out stories, because Moonlin is Taiwanese as well. The thing is, in Taiwanese culture, at least from what I know, my dad's sister made a comment, you better be careful, your daughters are very beautiful, about my little sisters, and she didn't know about me. And then she's like, you know, nowadays I hear there's lesbians all around, so you better be careful.
Oh my God.
When I went to Taiwan is actually, surprisingly, I was really surprised about this, Taiwan is one of the most openly accepting of the gay community in Asian countries, and they have one of the largest LGBT pride celebrations. This I did not know, but my mom's side, where it's Malaysian, when we went to Malaysia, we had to be a bit more secretive, and I'm very anti-hidden, and I don't like that. I don't feel like I need to hide myself whatsoever. However, this came to a point where it did feel like our lives were at stake, because you can get killed if they find out. We weren't showing extreme affection. We were just walking, you know, and if people wondered, they probably thought we might,
just close friends.
Right. Yeah. Or like even sisters, sadly. But in Taiwan, we can hold hands. But also culturally, women growing up, young girls growing up in Taiwan, and even parts of Malaysia where little girls just hold each other's hands, even middle school and high school, and it's not a thing. So a lot of girls who are lesbians and don't want to come out in Taiwan,
they can kind of it off as friends.
Exactly. So I think for my dad, it was hardest for him. Yeah. He's Taiwanese, and it was really difficult for him, but he's so accepting of it right now. But it was hard for him. It took a few months for him to really swallow it and realize like it's a real thing. It was sweet. He started clipping all these newspapers in Chinese, in the Taiwanese newspapers, telling my mom to make sure to send it to me. You know what the clippings were of? How Taiwan is super open about gay people and that they're very accepting. I was crying when I heard that.
Parents do things in the small, important ways.
Damn it, Dad. Really? Now you're going to do this to me right now? And I'm like crying. Also, I did luck out because my grandpa is on my mom's side. He's an artist. Because he's an artist already, he doesn't see this whole gay, straight situation. He's like, you love who you love. What the fuck is the problem?
Oh, God, I like your grandfather very, very much.
Oh, yeah, he's so dope. And he was like straight up like ripped my mom and dad a new asshole and all of his daughters, my aunts. And one of my aunts is super supportive. She's like, honey, of course we still love you. What kind of ridiculous question is that? If anyone has a problem, that is their problem. Screw them, da da da. Honey, we love you no matter what. We can't wait to meet Moonlin. Hate to use the word again, but very lucky, you know?
Yeah, fortunate.
Very fortunate in that aspect here and compared to other friends who I have a gay best guy friend. He's Israeli. He's, you know, Jewish background. And the parents still don't really acknowledge. They know, but they don't want to know. They forget.
I mean, one of my best gay friends, when she came out, her older sisters messaged her and were basically like, how dare you think about what your happiness is doing to our family? Just like you were saying earlier. And that's so sad. I'm glad that they're supportive, that they've come around to it.
Thank you so much. I do appreciate that. It was shocking for everybody. One of my other aunts, I thought she'd be the most supportive, but she was the most shocked and the most in denial.
Do you think it's one of those ones where it's that close to home concept?
I'm so cool with everybody as long as it's not one of my own.
Which is weird because it's also the flip side of it that can bring people around if they've not had interactions with a member of the community. It's like you see that what happened with Republican politicians where all of a sudden one of their children is gay and suddenly they have to rethink all of their hate spewing.
Talking about rethinking a lot of things and parents, my mom and dad, I'm so proud of my mom. Yeah. What she did recently this past year with my dad, she started a company, a manufacturing company in New York. Uh-huh. She ended up, and this is like going up against partners too, she forced this retirement plan for their employees to be open for gay people too and to not discriminate.
Oh, good.
It was amazing where she's like, honey, look at what you inspired. Look at this. Like, look at what we're doing, where there were other companies in that field that are like, this is only applied for straight people. This retirement program will not be allowed for gay people. But for her specifically, she requested, she's like, make sure there's no discrimination against gay people. Make sure that this covers their family too, covers them and everything. And I was so moved.
That's so wonderful. Real on the ground growth. That's so much progress from coming to that place of when she first heard, you know?
Yeah.
So sometimes when I tell my friends about what my dad said when I first told him, they're like, oh my God, how rude. And I'm like, you don't understand. That for my father was the closest he would ever come to being able to be like, I'm okay with it. He's like, well, then we basically like both have the same type. He will point out a beautiful girl to me, be like, isn't she pretty? And I'm like, oh, you are both very pervy right now and trying so hard, and I appreciate it, but also no, stop.
That's so funny.
He's trying. He didn't do it to be like insensitive.
Thank you so much for diving into that with me. Our listeners were freaking incredible. They got really excited in the Facebook group. Let's kick it off with Megan LaCroix. First of all, she says, please tell you that she says hi from all of us, a community. So she said that she'd love to know
your process and your tips for creating, writing morally ambiguous characters because you do it so well.
Oh, well, thank you, Megan, first of all. I'm definitely always drawn to outsiders more than insiders as protagonists. And to be honest, I think it comes with the fact that I think that a story is only as good as its villain. And so at some point I was like, wait a second. Why do I have to have a hero then? Like, why can't I just take the person that you would root for as the villain and find a way to make another villain too?
Nice.
And so then you end up getting two villains instead of a hero and a villain. And it's just, in the end, what it comes down to is everybody wants something in this world. What I actually hate most are flat villains, or villains that are just in it for world domination or whatever it is. I think that it's so much more compelling, whether you're writing an anti-hero or a antagonist, a villain or a protagonist, this idea of, can you create a person with self-interest, right? Can you make it personal? Mm-hmm. Because that's what makes people relatable, right? They don't have to be likable. They have to be sympathetic, meaning you have to understand why they do what they do. And so for me, I sit down with each and every one of my characters and I ask, what do they want and what do they fear? And those two questions and the answers to those questions inform the entire character. And I think I try to write what would come off as morally ambiguous characters because I'm interested in writing real people. And the fact is the vast, vast majority of us have self-interest and operate from a place of self-interest. Mm-hmm. And so I think I actually find characters to be more unrelatable or at least less realistic when they operate from just this place of selflessness, especially if they're women. Nothing frustrates me more than the idea in fiction, especially in YA or in fantasy, that if you give a woman power, she must also be completely willing to fight it.
Oh, yes.
YA men don't have to do that. But the idea that, like, if you make a woman strong, you must also make her selfless. And I'm like, no, that's bullshit. When I was 16, I would have burned the world down to be happy. You're going to give a 16-year-old girl power, and the thing she's going to do is she's going to save the world with it at her own cost? No, no. One, I don't buy it. And two, I think that as we get older, our self-interest codifies. And so that's who my characters are. My characters are people who are operating from a place of self-interest. I free them in one way or another. I make them less intertwined with other people, at least at the start, so that they can truly embrace that self-interest in the beginning. And then what it becomes over the course of my books is an exercise in moderating self-interest, not in being willing to give it all up for the sake of another person. I don't like that idea. I like the idea of, how do you compromise? What happens when you take a person who has been given free rein to be self-interested, to be selfish, and then you introduce something into their life that they care about? They don't have to care about it as much as they care about themselves, but all you have to do is introduce doubt into a person's head. And that's how you get an ambiguous moral character.
Damn, you just threw it down. Your characters are very delicious, I must add. Thank you for that. Wow, and I feel like you knocked out a few other people's questions too while answering that. So the next one is from Joshua Clark. He's so excited. He said, this is awesome. Love Victoria and her work. Knowing that Victoria writes adult, YA, and middle grade books, which age group voice is most natural to write or finds the easiest to tap into? Then to go with that, which do you find more challenging to find the right voice?
Oh, that's such a good question. Also, thank you, Joshua, for not phrasing it as, which do you like writing more? Because that so often gets phrased in that way, and it's frustrating to me because obviously I like writing all of them. That's why I do it. Each and every one of them is me writing to a specific version of myself, a specific age. So my middle grade novels are just me writing for 10-year-old me. Or 12-year-old me, and my YA novels are me writing for 17-year-old me, and my adult novels are me writing for whatever age I'm at that point. To that end, the adult voice is the easiest one for me, or the most natural, simply because it's just who I am right now. And as I'm writing to the age that I am currently at, it requires fewer removes. Whereas when I'm writing a middle grade series I'm working on right now, it starts up next year, I think. It's not been announced yet, so I can't say what it is, but I always have to remind myself of that. But as I'm writing that, obviously I'm writing to 10 to 12-year-old me, and I'm still very much that person, but it's an iteration I haven't been now for almost 20 years. And so it's hard. I have to adjust my voice a little bit. YA is the least natural for me because I kind of jumped straight from 10 to 85 in my head. I very much was the 15-year-old that was like, get off my lawn. So I've never been like a hyper emotional person. And while I understood at that age the sense that the world was ending, the sense that like everything was a zero or a 10, I still was never very in tune with my own emotions at that age. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard for me to sometimes dial up the emotion as much as is expected in YA. That's not to say to dial up the romance or something, but to dial up the intensity. So for me, the YA voice is the least natural, the thing I have to work at most. The adult voice is the most natural, specifically Vicious, which is my supervillain story, is basically autobiographical.
A lot of our listeners are in love with Vicious.
Oh, thought you should know that. It's just a supervillain origin story. And it's about like two medical school students that discover the key to superpowers are near-death experiences. And they set out to manufacture their own superpowers using their own suicides and resurrections. It's very dark. And it goes off this idea that I hated the idea of the word superhero, because it's this idea that you give a person powers and suddenly they become heroic. And I'm like, no, imagine you're a real person. And you've just been given superpowers. You don't become a superhero. You become a real person with superpowers. And you would use those powers for all of your fickle, selfish needs. You would use it to get ahead in your job. You don't suddenly become Superman. You don't have a moral imperative to go with your power. And that's the whole idea behind Vicious, is what happens when you don't become a superhero. You just become a bad person.
All right, we get it. You're brilliant, okay?
I got nothing else, right?
And I'm going to do a part two to Josh's question, by the way. I'm assuming that he follows your work or follows you on social media, because he says he's curious how you find time to be such a voracious reader and write as many projects as you do. And by the way, he's really excited for your episode.
So I do a thing where, because it's not hard enough writing books, I also read about 100 books a year. I mean, I read a very, very, very broad spectrum, right? So everything from nonfiction memoirs and biographies to graphic novels to middle grade, YA, adult genre, adult literary. The truth is, I consider it part of my job. Nothing has made me a stronger writer than becoming a better reader. The key there is, do not just read 100 books of something you know you love. That is not how you become a stronger writer. You become a stronger writer by reading broadly, by reading diversely, by reading things which you know you will like and things which you don't think you will like. You become a strong reader by studying things that work and things that don't work. I like to say I have this story monster, right? It lives inside my chest. It feeds off of input to that creative well. It feeds off of stories. And I'm not sitting there studying each and every book, looking for its structural flaws and strengths. What I'm doing is I'm informing that intuitive sense that you get. The more books you read, and the more things you watch, and the more things you listen to, the better you become at innately or intuitively telling what works and what doesn't. So you feed this story monster, you make it smart and strong, without even trying, and you'll discover that as then you're working on your own projects, you'll have little lights go off in your head that say, this beat doesn't feel right. This should be tenser. This should be more of a moment. And what you're doing is you have fed yourself. You have toned all of those muscles.
Yes.
I truly consider reading to be part of my job. And I'm a full-time writer. And that means I'm a full-time reader. I do not expect everyone out there who is juggling school or work or family to go out and read that many books. But you can make time. I listen to books when I'm in the car. I listen to books when I'm going on walks. I listen to books at the gym. I read paper books or my Kindle for probably about 45 minutes a day. And it adds up.
I have never heard anyone break it down like that.
If you're just gorging on one kind of fiction, you're not becoming more rounded, you're not reaching, you're not stretching. It's like the people who only work on one book and they work on that book for their entire lives. And at some point you have learned everything you're going to learn from writing that damn book.
That's true.
You maybe have to go write another book now.
No wonder you're so damn good at what you do, because you're like, strengths everywhere. I'm interjecting with my own question is, I mean, shit, you read so many books. Holy crap. I am such a slow reader. That's why I love audiobooks. I'll listen to it 3 times the speed. I read so freaking slow. Moonlin can read a book in 1 day.
I don't have family. I don't have children. This is part of my full-time job. And I don't have a television. The thing is, though, because I don't have a television, I don't channel surf. So I watch things with intent. And because I watch things with intent, I watch a lot. I waste a lot less time. I don't think that watching television is wasting time. I think that channel surfing is wasting time. So I tend to watch one show at a time. So like right now I'm picking away at Supergirl and rewatching Parks and Rec because my life was feeling like it needed some Leslie Knope in it. The point is, because of that, you can skim about 45 minutes a day that someone else might waste watching an episode of Real Housewives that they're not actually that into. I basically spend that time reading instead. So I give myself like one or two episodes of television a day, and then I spend the rest of the time reading.
Watching with intent. By the way, you know, when you were mentioning about your middle grade, one of our listeners, I'm scrolling down, Tara Turley Creel mentioned that. So she asked a few questions, but the third part of her question was, she said, I think I saw on Twitter, she's writing a middle grade book. Any info on that? And how is it different than her previous writing processes works? And then another one of our listeners, Tia Bearden, she says, you might recognize her. She's been awesome in her community. Tia wrote the last she heard about The Returned.
God, yeah. That's the third book in a YA series.
She heard that you have very little time to work on it.
Yeah, that's still my status update on The Returned.
This is a funny part I had to read to you. So another listener, Lacey Hogg, jumps in and she wrote, we should organize a work detail to do all her unwanted chores so she can complete The Returned, wink face. I'd clean Victoria Schwab's house. And then Tara jumps in and says, yes, Lacey, I need that book. Haha. I'll even claim toilets to get this process moving faster.
Okay. The thing is, and I'll like, this is basically, so The Returned is the third book in a series that started with The Archive. So it's The Archive, The Unbound, and The Return. This is not just about me having the hours in the day to write this book. Yes, I have to put my contracted work first. The thing is that The Archived and The Unbound are with Disney, Hyperion. That was my very first publisher. And I'm not with Disney Hyperion anymore. And it was not a great relationship. For me, there's several layers to that. There's the fact that it's emotionally incredibly stressful, even returning to the series, because it's got a huge amount of emotional weight to it for me. And it was one of those things where for the 2 years after I left that publisher, I would cry at the mention of the series, right?
Oh, man. It's like a bad breakup.
It was a very abusive relationship, led to a very bad breakup, right?
Yeah.
And so for me, it's tricky. I need to have the time to do it. I have to do it in such a way that it's not contract breach with any of my three existing publishers, because you can't publish anything that's competing work. At this point, what we're going to do, I'm waiting for The Archived and The Unbound rights to return back to me. And once the rights for book 1 and 2 return back to me, then we can explore the option of republishing all three books together. I don't really have an interest at this point, 4 years off, of just self-publishing it, because I don't think that's the best thing for this story. And honestly, I do not have the energy to do self-publishing. That is its own art form. And I am a traditional published author because I do not have the energy. So for me, the reason I keep asking people for patience is, one, it's incredibly emotionally abusive situation, even still, to return to. But also, I need to wait for The Archived and The Unbound to come back into my court.
Number one, I'm so sorry that you had to go through that. I don't have any idea of what that's like per se for my own self with writing and to get to that point. But for my own worlds, when I came from acting, I was in a very abusive relationship basically with an ex-manager.
So you understand, trust me.
I was threatened a lawsuit when I had the right to leave and they were still threatening. I just spent 5 years of my life with you and you had so many opportunities. You let it slip. You let the ball drop how many times? And I could have left when the person who found me in that management office left 2 years into my contract. Uh-huh. It was hinted I could have left, but I still felt bad trying to like play this moral high ground of, oh, maybe it's better to just stay still because it's not okay to leave.
That's the problem.
That was so new. And I was telling my girlfriend.
I was so young.
By the way, found out that they forged my signature so that my checks from SAG would go to them. They could still take commission before sending it over.
Once you're out of those situations, it's really hard to revisit them.
It is so hard.
I don't have anything against Disney. It was an unfortunate situation in which there was a lot of moving parts and people left, and I got orphaned in the process of it. And it's really unfortunate the way that it all unraveled. It made me the author from a business standpoint that I am today. And as I near 30, I'm very glad to be a stronger and more self-sufficient person than I was at the time. But it's a painful question. And again, this is an embarrassment of riches, I know this, but every single time I announce any form of good news, I get a wave of people who only care about that series. And it's frustrating. And I know that it's frustrating to feel like you haven't gotten a completion for something. I get that too. I want the series to be finished for my own edification and for my own closure. It also means revisiting something that I very much don't want to revisit emotionally. And so it's just one of those things where I'm continually asking for patience. It's not like I'm trying to blow off readers. I got very angry a few months ago when I had a reader insinuate that I had just lost interest. They hadn't done their homework, read any of the, gone back and done any of the research into the backstory, and they just assumed I was blowing off the series because I cared about other series more. And it's not that at all. I care about that series so much.
I'm so sorry about that.
You grow from it because you don't have a choice. It was basically, it put me at a point in my career where I almost walked away because I was quite young. It would have been very easy to walk away. It would have certainly been the easiest answer. And had I not been writing Vicious, that supervillain story, on the side as a way to salvage my love of creative process, I would have walked away. But it just so happened that within the month of this all going down with my publisher, I finished Vicious and I decided to sub it for, and it sold, and it started an entire new chapter of my life. And now every time I sell a new book, I'm like, ain't going nowhere, bitches.
That's right. Cheers to that. I'll be cheering you from the other side of the country. That's amazing. I love that spirit. That's positivity. I mean, it's going to keep you going. Also, sometimes you just got to be like, fuck it.
Exactly. I am in a much better place than I was when it all went down, thanks to like 10 book deals, some film deals, and some New York Times bestseller lists. I have a little bit of retrospect. But again, that is not to put any antagonism toward the askers of that question. It only hurts me because I care so much.
I think that really helps the listeners too when they hear this. Also, a lot of these listeners are writers as well. So I think it's a whole new perspective that they probably were never aware of.
I'm the asshole that people are like, I want to be a writer. And my very first question, I will tell you this straight up. When people tell me that, the first thing I ask is, does anything else make you happy? If it does, do that thing instead. And I feel like that's similar to acting.
If you love heartbreak and you love rejections and you love that kind of love-hate relationship, then okay. Go for it.
I was talking to a girl the other day. And I was like, you don't understand. It's just not gentle. Writing is beautiful. Everybody should write. Publishing is hell. And you should engage with it at your own risk. And something that I say to that extent as well is there's a lot of fear of rejection. I'm a very, very firm believer that rejection exists in this industry, not only to test whether your craft is ready, but to test whether your ego is. Like, you have got to embrace rejection. I still get rejected all the time. It's a sign that I'm pushing myself, that I'm stretching and putting myself out there. There is no point in this game at which rejection ceases to be a factor. And so if you're in the early stages of writing, become extremely acclimated and find a way to cultivate stubborn hope. Because if you get shaken easily by rejection, this is not an industry for you. Hashtag tough love.
Everything you're saying, I'm like, girl, you are preaching about acting life.
Very similar. It's the creative exposure. It's vulnerability of having to be judged on a piece of yourself.
These opinions, it's not just yourself. It's all these other people, and you're part of the larger machine that's happening. Exactly. And this is show business. This is publishing is like show business. I'm sorry, but it is.
And I had an author get really up in my face one time when I said that. I asked aspiring writers that. They were like, how could you do that? This is the best industry in the world. And I'm like, that is an unrealistic thing you've just presented. That is not a kindness. This is not an industry on kindness. This is a tribe. You earn your way into this tribe, not by getting published, not by being in movies. You earn your way into this tribe by not quitting.
This is the kind of preaching I'm all about. Okay, so let's jump into the next listener question. I know that was very much appreciated, and everybody's probably nodding their heads right now listening to that. So thank you. So next listener question from Alyssa Von Helms. What pre-writing things does she do to get herself in the mode? Do you get up at 4 a.m., drink coffee? Do you always write after dark, nibbles on candy? I mean, we kind of covered this where you're just flexible and do whatever you want.
I always have to have a cup of tea. I do not eat and work at the same time because it's the only time I build in my breaks is when I'm eating, right? So when I'm eating, that's when I'm watching something on Netflix. Like, that's when I am giving myself a break. Also because if I had a thing of Honey Nut Cheerios at hand while working, I would eat the whole thing of Honey Nut Cheerios. I wouldn't even think about it because it's an oral fixation when you're working, right?
Yes.
So I try to just have a cup of tea. I hate to admit to this because it really shouldn't be this way. Usually I've got to get dressed. Like there are people who are like, I write in bed. I have to treat it like a job in that sometimes to get myself going in the morning, I walk to the coffee shop. I have to put on clothes and treat it like a job.
By the way, what tea do you like to drink?
Okay, totally changes over the course of the day. I'm a complete tea snob. My mom is English, so it's in the blood at least. I start with a really strong English or Scottish breakfast tea. I drink my tea with nothing in it.
I'm the same way. I like straight up pure
tea. And that's how you can tell if it's good tea.
Yes.
And then over the course of the day, I switch to either a China green tips or sometimes a peppermint, depending on how I'm doing. And then I end with chamomile.
I want to recommend Taiwanese oolong tea.
Oh my God, I love oolong. I go from like a strong, strong Chinese black to a oolong to a Darjeeling.
Okay, so you like the very pungent, very thick, earthy taste.
I drink tea like coffee. So for me, it's got to, can't taste like something in water. It has to taste robust.
Then that means I think you would like pu'er if you haven't tried that yet.
Never tried that.
Pu'er, it really helps, from what I hear, also helps to lower high blood pressure and also high cholesterol. So it has a very dark, earthy taste.
I'm not super big on flavor. Like, I like my teas to taste like, to be on the earthier end of the spectrum. Peach or rooibos or anything like that. I'm not so much in that vein.
You might be okay with pu'er. I think you would still love oolong more, but pu'er is something to try out because if you love oolong, then definitely stay with oolong. It's fantastic oolong. If you get really great ones, nicely plucked ones right at the start of spring from Taiwan, I mean, you're going to love that. But just try pu'er because it is good for your health. It's something to be aware of and you could change things up a bit.
Definitely. All right. I'm definitely going to have to check that out. I need some more oolong in my stash. I would say, if you have any good recommendations.
Yes. I'm going to talk to Moonlin because she knows all about the oolongs and if there's like specific names. Because I know her mom bought over some really incredible oolong. And the problem is we don't know the name in English. And you have to buy in Taiwan. We're all tea fanatics here. All right. Who do we have next? We have Amanda Christie Connolly. Oh man, she has so many questions. But to start with, how do you approach writing with the ups and downs of a mental health condition and find ways to channel that into your work? Also, what tips and tricks do you have for nailing the voices of characters in multiple points of views?
Well, the mental health one, because mental health is usually an obstacle, not a boon. I think one of the most important things with mental health and with writing, there's a really interesting overlap here of self-examination. So often to be a good writer, you actually have to be quite willing to self-examine, because so much of writing is catharsis, whether that's the intent or the subconscious. It's so much of it is us working through something. And so I honestly think it's kind of the same in mental health of you can't make concrete progress unless you're open to self-examination. And to be really honest with yourself and to really break things down. And it's the same in writing. And so in a way, the hope is that one can help the other. And if you're stuck on one side, you're probably not going to find a whole lot of freedom on the other side. I struggle with really severe anxiety and circuitous thinking and stuff. It's day by day. It's something where it impedes the creative process sometimes. And then I get angry because it's not a thing you can account for. It's hard for me because I travel so much for work. And that's a lot harder for me, actually, than anything else, is being on for that much time, because it's this idea of not wanting to let anybody down. I struggle really hard with panic attacks and stuff on tour, except for me, panic attacks don't look like someone hyperventilating into a bag. Panic attacks look like me being violently ill in a bath doll. Everything goes to my stomach. Everything. Which is one of the reasons teas are so important. So for me, I have this fear of letting people down. And when you're an author, especially when you're an author who's having 100 to 250 people come to your book events, there's this idea of, holy shit, people came all the way to see me. The worst case scenario, because mental illness, it's all about worst case scenario. The worst case scenario is I feel ill and then I leave all of these people disappointed and then they walk away with resentment and then they take it out on my books, right? That's the spiral that goes through my head. So then I become afraid of feeling ill, which makes me feel ill. And so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy all over the place, right? For me, I have to be self-aware. I hate to make it reductionist like that, but so much of it is being honest, not only with myself, but with people around me. I've been forced myself to be open about it online, which then leads bookstores to contact me before I do events there to ask if there's anything they can do to make the event easier for me, whether it's positioning me so that I'm not backed into a corner, quite literally, or whether it's giving me a break. It's making it so that the readers and I are on the same page, right? If we're in it together, because so much of it for me is keeping it secret if I'm suffering, and that only perpetuates more trouble. And I think whether you're a touring author or whether you're a person facing down a blank page, the rules are the same. You have to be self-aware and you have to be honest with yourself and with those that you care about and that care about you, because that kind of transparency can save you. It's not easy to let people in that way and to entrust them with that, but it's important.
Thank you for that. I think that's going to help a lot of the community.
There's this thinking that it's a lifetime sentence, right? And in some ways it is. It is something you will fight with forever. But the great lie of both anxiety and depression is that it will never get better. That's the great lie. The great lie is when you're in that space, you think this is a degenerative condition. It will only get worse. I remember thinking that so vividly so many times of my best days are behind me. And that's the psychological trap. You have to look at it as a roller coaster. There will be lows, but there will also be highs. And you cannot get stuck in the perpetuating of the now. What you're feeling at that moment when you're at your worst, that is a moment. And it feels like a forever. And it's just a moment. And so sometimes it's just getting yourself to the next moment.
I was diagnosed with depression when I was younger. And it's something that when the lows are really low, like you said, you think that that's it. It's just going to get worse. But really, truly, as I've learned as I got older, it's really just, it's not a disability that's going to hold me back. It's just, what do I need to do for myself in my own way that works for me, that just gets me through those little blips?
It's about recognizing that there's this part of you that is not all of you.
I absolutely agree. You're a whole person, and you're also not defined by that either.
Not at all. But you're also not weak if you have a day where the most that you can do is human.
Yeah.
I still, for all of my work, will have days, hopefully rare ones, wherein the very most that I can do is get through the day. And that is not a weakness. I get told, you know, I have a lot of wonderful readers come to my events, many of them who face depression and anxiety, and they look at me and they say, I could never do what you do. I will never be able to cope with my anxiety or depression levels to be where you're at. And I'm like, don't do yourself the disservice. One, no mental health looks the same. We all bear it differently. We all cope differently, but also it's all a process. It's all a process. And where you're at in your life right now is not a sentence for where you will always be. There are ways to make progress, and your progress is going to look different than everyone else's progress. But the last thing that you can afford to do if you're facing depression or anxiety is resignation. Don't resign yourself to it. Find the most that you can bear and sit up against that boundary and just try and inch it little by little.
I couldn't have said it better. And then I heard your cat going, yes. All right.
My
She's
cat,
like, yes, mama.
He's so obnoxious and has like climbed halfway up my bookcase at this point.
He's like, why are you not giving me attention? Why are you still talking right now? Are you serious?
He's, how long have you been on that chat? He's like, I'm sorry. How long?
He's like, you know I'm starving here, right? Where's my food? Where's my catnip and all that stuff?
He's not subtle.
That was the best way to end that part, by the way, was his voice going, yep.
Right? Yep. His little mew of agreement.
He's letting you know, I approve, mama. I approve what you said. Good job. So I'm going to go to the second part of Amanda's question was also, what tips and tricks do you have for nailing the voices of characters in multiple points of view?
Oh God, I don't know. I mean, I genuinely don't. There are questions that's hard for me to answer because I haven't really found words for them. I write primarily in third person close perspective. I used to write in first person, and it drove me slightly crazy how hard it was for me to differentiate some specific voices. And I found that I had an easier time differentiating points of view in third person, because you are still inside the character's head, but you're not so upright against them. So what I was able to do then is play with some linguistic elements. I was able to play with the rhythm and flow of sentences. The way that Victor Vale and Vicious form sentences in his head is going to be very different from anybody else. He's incredibly psychically removed. He's very cold and analytical. Delilah Bard has a very specific writing style that goes with her. So I create a few rules for myself. Who uses long sentences? Who is formal? Who is informal? How do they see the world? One of the best examples I can give probably is August Flynn, who's in The Savage Song and Our Dark Duet. He's a young soul-eating monster who is also a musician. And he specifically sees the world in terms of music. He uses, as far as the vast majority of characters rely on sight as their primary sense. And they always, writing courses always tell you, utilize all five senses. But for August, he textualizes most things in terms of musicality. He goes through the world picking out the notes. And so I know when I'm writing in his voice that when he walks into a room, when he exercises his descriptive faculties, the thing he's going to process first and foremost is sound, always. He has very sensitive hearing and he's a musician. Whereas counterpart in the story, Kate Harker, is deaf in one ear. And so for her, sound is a weakness. Like sound is the thing that she is lacking in times. And so she becomes very aware of when she's not able to hear things. And so I pick different things. You know, we as people move through the world in very different ways. And an artist will walk into a room and assess it one way. A military person will walk into that room and immediately look for the exit. Figuring out your character's literal perspective on the world, not just writing their POV. You have to come to understand who your character is. And what matters to them? Delilah Bard is a thief. She is always expecting to be robbed or conned. She interacts with her environment in a very different way than Kel does. And then that translates into when you're writing their point of view. What is important to these people? Whatever is important to them is the thing that they're going to prioritize in their scenes.
Leaving everybody speechless.
Put things into words that I don't actually normally put into words. So I'm having to think through it at the same time.
Well, then this is ridiculous because it sounds like you've practiced this over and over again because you sound perfect.
Through it.
Cheers to making everybody else jealous again, but in the best way possible.
It's a ruse.
Oh, God. Well, it's a well done one. Before going to the next ones, remember in the beginning we were talking about transparency and how you're very, very open about things. I came across Tia Bearden. She said she is a huge fan of yours and she's shown up at as many as she could. Yeah. And, you know, we were talking about the transparency and this is the one that I wanted to read to you where she's, there are so many things that she loves about Victoria, about you. But it's your utter transparency about how hard writing is gives her so much hope and strength. And she says, she knows that sounds horrible, that you've accomplished so much and that you make her feel less alone. So I just need to put that out there. Those are from her words.
That's why I do it. Again, I'm not transparent for my edification. I'm not transparent because it makes me comfortable. It doesn't make me comfortable being transparent. I do it specifically because I entered this business quite young. My first book sold when I was 21, 22 and about to turn 30. So I've been doing it now for almost a decade. And this is an opaque industry. Much like the movie industry, they tell you nothing. It's purposeful. I don't think it's done with malice, but it's done with intent. It's done to make you as a creator feel like an island. So when something goes wrong, you feel like it's just you. You discount it. And you add to that this notion that we have as an industry, this pressure for authors to always be putting forward only good news. So you feel on top of it then like everyone else is a success and you're a failure. You feel like everyone else is just flying high and having an easy time. And you're the only one that for whom this is difficult. And it's maddening. And then I remember I went to an author's retreat, a group of about 25 authors when I was a debut author. And all of these people who sat online and just talked about their latest book deals and their foreign deals and their film deals and how wonderful everything was, everyone poured a glass of wine and talked about what shit the industry was. And then someone said, wait a second, I've been sitting here miserable thinking that I'm a failure, and everyone else is on this up curve. And what it is instead is that nobody else was talking about it, right? And everyone was like, oh, but no, you can only put forward the good. You only put forward the good. And I was like, how does that help anyone. That might help your publisher, but how does that help your readers? How does that help the aspiring authors? How does that make any of this feel accomplishable to anyone who's not already inside the game? And that's why I'm transparent, is because, like, this is a hard industry. It is a dream job, but it is still a job. And if you come into it without the faculties, without the mental and psychological preparation, it will eat you. But if you can come into it, if I can give readers and aspiring writers even a modicum of insight into that, and then when they start to struggle, they can be like, oh, but Victoria Schwab struggles too. So then you can know that this isn't something you overcome. This isn't something that is a judgment on whether or not you're good or not. This is something we all face together, right? And I stops one person from quitting, then it's worth being transparent.
Yes, absolutely. And okay, along the side of that, Rihanna Winningham, another one of our listeners, she was talking about self-doubt, and she wants to know if you felt it, and it's clear that, you know, from our conversation that you have before, but what do you do to get past it? What do you do? And I'm sure Rihanna's probably gone through it herself, hence why she's asking. So yeah, whatever you want to dish out with that.
I have this incredible ability to retcon my memory so that in the midst of writing something, it's hell and I'm feeling capable. And then as soon as it's done, I'm like, that was amazing, guys. That was so much fun. Only in that I'll start the next project and start bemoaning it. And I'll think, oh my God, why can't this be easy like the project before? At which point, all of my friends and family will look at me and will they be like, are you high? And then they will show me the receipts. They will show me the emails and the phone calls and everything that I inundated them with for 6 months before when everything was miserable. So part of it is honestly just understanding the cycle of lies that your brain tells yourself. I will never escape self-doubt. In fact, the more books I write, the harder it gets to write a first draft. The reason being, the more aware you are of what's wrong. But the simple fact remains, whether you're writing your first book or your 13th book, which is the one that I just finished, you cannot fix a blank page. So it's not about getting over self-doubt and more about the sheer fact that I can't make it better if I don't make something to start with. I'm going to hate it. The whole time I'm writing that first draft, I'm going to hate it. I might forget I hate it for like 5 minutes at a time. But like most of all, I'm going to hate it. And then the revision process is this narrowing between the idea in your head and the thing on paper and slowly, slowly erasing your self-loathing of the book. But no, self-doubt is a continuous companion. Now, there's a really important difference between self-doubt and the little red flag in your head that says this book has taken a wrong turn. One of those things you don't listen to and the other one you do. You have a little voice in your head that you train with the story monster technique, and you will start to get a gut feeling when the book is gone wrong. That is not self-doubt. That is your brain or your heart or something trying to tell you that you have gone astray. And that part, so much of this business, so much of this process is learning to differentiate between self-loathing and self-doubt and that voice that is actually valid, which is a self-editor. And that just comes with trust. That comes with learning your process, learning your voice, learning all of these things. But self-doubt is your albatross. It is your constant companion and you will never get rid of it. And the day that it's no longer there, you have done something wrong. I asked one of my writing heroes a couple of years ago, Neil Gaiman. I asked him, I said, do you still feel self-doubt? This is a man who has been published for 35 years, who is one of the science fiction and fantasy's golden children.
Yeah, I mean, he's freaking massive. Yes.
And he said, every blank page. So understanding that it is part of the tribe. It is a waste of time to get rid of self-doubt. What you're trying to do is drown it out with other things. But it's a voice that's going to be there the whole time.
You better be doing speaking engagements. I know you travel a lot for your book tours.
I hate public speaking so much.
Wait, you don't speak at all?
Well, I do at my events. My thing is, I like this kind of format with question and answer. I cannot get up in front of a crowd and just speak. That shit drives me crazy. Also, thing you have to understand, I had such a horrific fear of speaking. When I was 21, when I sold my first book, I had a 2-year window before it came out. And I spent that entire 2 years becoming comfortable speaking to an invisible audience. I started a YouTube channel. That was the only way that I became comfortable doing this.
Oh, shoot. It sounds like you have gone through some serious media training.
Literally just me. It's just me, man.
It sounds like you have a whole team that's teaching you how to talk. For this Disney film that I did, they threw my ass into media training and I was not having it. I did not like it. I was like, I was just cast as a teenager, but I am not a teenager. I know I may look a little bit like a teenager, but don't come here telling me what to say. It was so crazy. They tell you literally how to speak, how to remove the ums, how to flow.
Oh, that's called having an English parent. You don't understand. So I never got media training. I went to etiquette camp.
Wait, what?
Etiquette camp, quotation marks, right? Was a great aunt of mine to whom I was shipped off every year for a week and rigidly trained. I was scolded for any of those intonational things. I was taught posture. I was taught manners. I mean, I am a product of an English upbringing.
Oh my Lord, your parents would not be happy with me being your friend because I am hunched over the computer talking and saying ums left and right.
It wouldn't actually matter if my father was English. I have an English mom. I have the kind of English mom who is lovely and adorable and all of 5 feet tall. But if words came out of my mouth in the wrong order, or if I used a word to excess, like one of my words to excess is obsessed. I like becoming quote unquote obsessed with things. I get such a scolding look.
My God.
Vocabulary, please exercise your full vocabulary. It was taught to me in the way of, oh God, what's the one that angers her so much? Hold on. Because I want to immortalize this by putting it on a podcast. It's one of those that witch kind of issues where if you use the wrong one, it's good and well. To the point where it was inundating me so much growing up. If my mom hears someone say good when they mean well, like how are you doing good? When the right answer to that is how are you doing well? She will like verbally correct. She will say it correct to the television. If I'm in an audience and someone says it, I mutter under my breath, well. This is how I was raised. I'm hugely flattered by the fact that you would think that I had the comportment to have any form of training in this.
You sound incredible. You're so well-spoken. It's insane the way you deliver each answer. I'm not even trying to be nice.
Especially because I'm just talking out my ass the whole time.
Girl, I wish I could talk out of my ass and sound so damn smooth the whole time too.
The only thing I have to work hard on, and I failed a little bit on this podcast, I have a sailor's vocabulary and I try so hard not to cuss. I don't cuss in written form, like on Twitter. It's a policy I have just because one, characters are valuable and I have a wide range audience. And it's just a rule I set for myself like 4 years ago. Like if I'm going to swear, I want it to mean something. In something like this, in just chatting, I have the worst.
Okay, well, I have to say sorry to your parents in advance, just in case they are listening in on this.
My mom will listen to this whole thing.
Mama Schwab, I am so sorry. Please forgive my mouth.
Oh no, she doesn't care about your mouth. She only cares what comes out of my mouth.
But you know what? We love it here. We love it. This community loves it and we embrace it. And we think it adds to the realness of our conversations.
I agree.
So at least your mom knows you're doing it for a good cause, okay? So it really, it does count.
Don't worry.
Don't kill me. And I know we've gone into 2.5 hours, but we have 2 more listener questions.
That's my chili at this point has gone to ash on the stove.
Oh my God, I forgot.
No, I stirred it like an hour ago, whatever.
Do you want to just go check that your turkey didn't evaporate?
Oh, no, it's fine. It's on low heat.
See, there we go. And also, you should stop taking your food out of the crock pot.
I know. Lessons I haven't learned.
We have Vanessa Andrew. She said, oh my God, I love her book. So exciting. And we recently had Beth Revis on the show. And Beth mentioned in her episode about the time where she was lining up with you.
JK Rowling.
Yes, JK Rowling.
And she almost threw up.
Yes. So Vanessa would love to know if you really would have dived in front of JK Rowling if Beth Revis was about to throw up from excitement.
Absolutely not. I would have put as much distance between myself and Beth as humanly possible. You understand? She looked actually green. And I was like, Beth, don't you dare. Don't you dare take this moment from me. But no, I would not dive bomb for any vomit coming out of anyone. The security team probably would have dive bombed Beth had she done that. so it would have been handled. But I was giving Beth such a death glare as we moved through that line because I saw her going green about the gill.
You guys are the cutest besties. I love you both. And I love that you're straight up and you're like, hell no, I would not have dived in. Hell no.
I really hate vomit. It's one of my only things that I literally can't stomach it.
All right. Well, I appreciate that realness. I do.
I love Beth. I love her. I have limits. Also, I don't need J.K. Rowling to be like associating me with the vomit. I gotta preserve any chance I have at that friendship.
Vanessa would also like to know, do you listen to the podcast called My Favorite Murder?
I just started listening to it. I can't believe I didn't listen to it sooner because I really love serial killers. It's kind of a thing.
I'm assuming she knows this, which is why she asked you.
With serial killers. I mean, I'm not like fascinated with them like I've got a like scrapbook. I'm just fascinated from a psychology perspective.
Yes.
Of what drives people to, like, I'm fascinated by sociopaths and psychopaths and serial killers. The Psychopath Test, if you haven't read it, is one of the most fascinating books I've ever read. It's by John Ronson. And okay. It's who did like So You've Been Publicly Shamed and Men Who Stare at Goats and all these things. But the Psychopath Test was eye-opening. Just started listening to it. I had to burn through S-Town last week.
I listened to the first episode, but I didn't get past the first episode.
You got to.
I know.
Go listen to episode 2, and by the end of episode 2, if you're not hooked, then you don't have to.
I was hooked by the first one. I just felt it was a little draggy.
But it just waits. It totally changes course. But My Favorite Murder, I actually need to just go to episode 2 because similarly, episode 1 was super draggy because they're basically just introducing why they're doing the show. And I'm like, I don't care about that. Get to the serial killers.
You haven't gone past the first one
No.
the second episode because Vanessa wanted to know if you had a favorite murder.
No.
I asked you too soon.
Yeah,
it was my fault.
I'm not like a scrapbook fan of serial killers. I have a morbidity issue and I'm fascinated by what makes people do horrible things. I mean, I'm also so hardcore Hannagram. I am all up in the Hannibal Will Graham fandom.
You know of Jeffrey Dahmer then?
Oh, yeah.
He was a whole worldwide phenomenon and the whole country was obsessed with him and wondering what made him tick and why he was able to do what he was doing and what was the reason behind it. So it's not just you. Don't worry. It's like the rest.
No. There's a reason that 20-something girls have an entire podcast called My Favorite Murder. My very first book was called The Near Witch and was just like this tiny little fairy tale set on the English moors. And then someone was like, but what about the Moor murders? And I was like, what? And I made the mistake of looking it up. And it was one of the most disturbing serial killer pairs, Moors, like M-O-O-R, in England, where children were taken and then buried out on the English moors. And I just was...
Were they buried alive or what?
They were tortured and murdered first. There were like 5 10-year-olds.
How many of them?
Like 5.
Did they find out who did this?
It was really, really dark. Hold on, I'm Googling it right now.
I'm assuming it's like a married couple. They didn't have children and they wanted children and then this is their way.
They took children and tortured them and then buried them, hid the bodies on the moor. Like wanting children and then living out these fantasies. They took the children not to like keep the children. They took the children to kill the children. And it was like a really couple. I'm always really weirdly disturbed when it's a couple.
This was in America years ago where there's one lady that she was pregnant, but they killed the person that picked them up as hitchhikers and they were both in on it and they enjoyed it.
That's so disturbing.
I think it scares me because it's two people who are in love and they're probably the thing that they have most in common is their thrill and love and fascination for murder.
Which is, I'm like, how did you guys even end up together? I don't know.
Did one convince the other? Because that's what I wonder too. I'm like, there's no way, because I feel in this whole world, for people to actually go through, I'm sure if you're pissed off, you're going to think like, oh my God, I want to kill my boss.
This was not a passion crime. This was something they did multiple times. One time is a passion crime. Multiple times is you're a serial killer.
The fact is that the two of them actually found each other.
I love stuff like Dexter, because I just love the idea. Because, of course, me at like 15, this says something about me in 15, was if I were to become a serial killer, what would my parameters be? Because like every serial killer has parameters. And the thing that I loved about Dexter is that's kind of what I would do. If I had that urge you can't slay, then I would go for bad people. Like at least be doing a public good out of it. There's a series by Dan Wells, a really great book series that's about a teenage serial, like a kid who has that gene, who has that urge, and how do you exist in the world without killing people when that's your desire? Oh my God. It just loaded on Goodreads. The Moors Murders. So it's Moors plural and Murders plural And they were carried out by, oh God, they even just look crazy, by Ian Brady and Mira Hindley in the 1960s. In Manchester, England, they were five children between the ages of 10 and 17. And they were sexually assaulted first. So this is not some parent child, like fake child shit. They were found in graves dug in on the Saddleworth Moor. They were really messed up killings. But I didn't even know about these. But anyway, I didn't even know about these. And then I do the thing where it's not that I actually like learning about them, but I can't not learn about them once I've heard of it.
Yes, in the same way.
And so someone brought this to me because my book is set on the English Moors. And then I like read everything. And the Wikipedia is like super long. And I couldn't stop reading it. And I was like, why?
So I'm going to squeeze in Kelsey's question for you, because it also kind of wraps up two other people's questions. So Kelsey Ford, she said, eek, one of my all-time favorite authors. This is so exciting. I'd love to hear her story of how she got her literary agent, how long she had to query, and tips for staying sane in that process. And along the same lines, while you're answering this, Rihanna Winningham asked a similar question about landing a literary agent, and she'd also love to know about your publishing journey from getting an agent to signing a deal. And she's also super excited to hear your episode.
Aw, you guys, you have like the best listeners. They're all so warm.
I'm very lucky. I don't know how we lucked out with them, but they got a lot of love and you could tell.
I have some of the best readers, like in terms of, because of that transparency and that positivity community.
There we go.
We just have a good overlap.
I think so. It's like a Venn diagram.
Basically, I didn't actually try writing a book until college, with a lot of writers have been writing books since they were 10 or 12 or whatever. I started out in poetry. And I went from there to short fiction, and I was intent on trying everything possible aside from book-length fiction, because I don't have that kind of attention span. And it just seemed like a lot of energy and I wasn't confident I could do it. And so I tried and I tried screenwriting and narrative nonfiction and essays and continue with the poems. And I was a sophomore in college when I realized that the reason I wasn't trying to write a book was because I was afraid. I was afraid that I would fail. I was afraid that I wouldn't have the focus. I wouldn't be able to do it. And I have a very adversarial nature when it comes to fear. I get angry. And so when I realized I had a fear of heights, I jumped out of an airplane. And when I realized I had a fear of change, I chopped off all my hair. And when I realized I had a fear of being away from home, I backpacked through Europe. And when I realized I had a fear of writing a book, I decided to sit down and write a book. And my first book, I wrote it over the course of about 6 months, and it was legitimately terrible, as every first book should be. I'm very suspicious when people's first book they claim is good, or it is good. I don't know. But I think that that first book is a learning process. But I was a poet. And so my book was very, very bad. And it had no plot, but it did have poetry. It was quite pretty. The lyric, like it had a lyrical sentences anyway. And that's important because I would revise it and I would try to get an agent with it and nobody would be interested. And then I entered... So this is still as a sophomore. I entered on a whim a contest on a blog called Nathan Bransford, who was a literary agent at the time, would host these contests about. So after like 6 months of revising it, I was like, this isn't going anywhere. And I shelved it. And then he had this contest up and there was about an hour until the contest was going to end. And it was a dialogue contest. You could submit 250 words of dialogue. And it's something I'm quite confident in is my dialogue. I like dialogue, and I had this quirky as hell scene in my quirky as hell book that had no plot, but was very pretty. And I thought, what the hell? So I end up, there's already 600 entries, and I end up dropping in 250 words of dialogue from this book that I had written called The Shadow Mile, which was basically Alice in Wonderland if Alice in Wonderland had even less plot and was set in the land of the dead. It had cool aspects to it, but it was not a book. It was a weird little acid trip experience. And anyway, and so Nathan Bransford picked the top three, and I was one of the top three. And the reward for that was if you were the top three, he would critique your query letter. Query letter being the pitch that you write. Side note, when you're writing query letters, for those who are writers, sorry, I'm like laying down now as I talk, and I feel like it's making me slower and more relaxed.
That's perfect.
I
love it.
Down in my chair. When you're writing a query letter, I think the most important thing to think of is the jacket copy on a book. Never tell more than the jacket copy on a book will. You're trying to entice an agent to read it, to ask more. You do not need to talk about subplots. You need not talk about secondary characters. If you pick up a book that you like, Go find a book that has good jacket copy, and you will notice it does not tell you very much. That is what you're doing. I read for an agency for a summer just out of curiosity to see how query letters were coming in from other people. And the biggest issues that I saw were people not being specific, trying to create those sweeping, and then everything goes horribly wrong statements, or telling way too much, like a summary style information. That's not what you're doing. You have 2 to 3 paragraphs to write the jacket copy, the like sellable, super intriguing copy of your book. Anyway, so I, as a top 3 contestant in this contest, he offered to look at my query letter. And I had like shelved this book at this point, but I pulled out the query letter and I sent it to him. And he was like, oh, I'll look at the pages for this. And it was the first time I was like, oh crap, maybe I should send this to some other agents too. And I did. This is where it gets complicated. I was very young. I was 19. And I cared more about being published than I did about how I was published. So I went with the very first agent who offered to me. She was young. She was very passionate at the time, very talented, but I was in a hurry. And I say that it's complicated because I do not regret going with this agent, but I also, if I had had 10 years of retrospect and any form of self-control, I would have taken the time and written another book first. But instead, I got my very first agent at 19, and this book went on sub, and it would get all the way up the food chain to acquisitions at 4 different publishers, and it would fail every time for 9 months. And I was emotionally drained after it, and I stopped. I was a college student, double majoring, just, you know, switching things around all the time, taking as many units as possible, and I didn't have time for it. And so I was exhausted by the fact that I kept failing. So I went back to focusing on school. And then I was a second semester senior when I realized that I was afraid again of not having written a book that sold. I didn't want to feel like a fluke. You know, one time is a fluke. And so I decided this was a moment where I was either going to not write and I would come back to this maybe 10, 15, 20 years later after having a career in something else, or I was going to sit down, I was going to get my shit together, and I was going to try again. By this point, I moved out of astrophysics and through 4 other programs, and I was in marketing and design because my parents were like, dear God, just graduate. And so I was studio space like 16 hours a day. It was very intense because I had to catch up on so much of the art school work. And I decided to take it seriously. So there was a coffee shop across the street that closed at 11. Every single night, 7 nights a week for 3 months, I checked out of my studio space and walked across the street and sat down at a table and wrote for 2 solid hours. I carved out that time. I made the time for something that was important to me. And over the course of those 3 months, I wrote the skeleton draft of what would become The Near Witch, which was my very first book. And it went on sub to, it went out on sub to publishers the week I graduated college. And my parents were lucky enough to give me that summer. I was like, just give me the summer to see if it sells. So September 1st rolls around, it hasn't sold. My parents are like, hey. And then on September 2nd, it sold. And it sold to Disney. And I was baby author. And essentially, I ended up rewriting the entire book after it sold to Disney because it wasn't a book. It was a skeleton draft of an idea. And so that was my first publication. And it would take me 9 more months to leave the agent, even though it was not a good relationship. I had been bonded with that agent. I was young. She was young. We were connected. We had been through a lot together. And then about almost a year later, I would fire that agent. And the same that I finally worked up the courage to fire her, you know, from the movie industry as well, it's very, very scary. And the same day that I fired her, I queried my 6 dream agents at this point, because I had done it wrong the first time. I wasn't about to do it wrong the second. And I did it wrong. I sent them 100 pages of a sequel to The Near Witch. Now, there is no sequel to The Near Witch. Disney decided not to publish it, but I was writing one at the time because Disney had told me to. And I sent out no sellable project for this new agent, literally just 100 pages. And hey, I'm being published by Disney. It's amazing that any of these agents took me seriously, but all 6 offered. And I ended up signing with Holly Root at Waxman Agency. And Holly and I have been together for just about 7 years now.
Damn, long term.
Old, 16 books for me in those 7 years.
What?
One of the best things that Holly did was we sat down together right after she signed and she said, let's talk about your career. Who do you want to be? Where do you want to be? This was an agent, and this is why I went with her. I wanted an agent who could take a long con vision for my life. I said, this is what I want to do. I want to be a full-time author. I'm going to make this work. And I was bored out of my mind at the time. I was a fast writer at the time. And I'm not a fast writer anymore. It turns out there's like lots of distractions to being an actual author. But at the time, I was a fast writer, and I had this very slow publication schedule. And Holly said, give it 3 years, and I guarantee you will never be bored again. And sure enough, within 3 years, I had three publishers. And Holly had delivered on every one of her promises. She's not, the thing I love about her is she's not an over-promiser. She will never promise you something she's not absolutely confident she can deliver on. And so I don't trust people who, and you know, I mean, I know this from LA, and you know this from LA. It's very, very popular to talk through the moon.
Yeah.
And then, you know, yes means no, mm-hmm. these different things. And I wanted a realist. Holly is brilliant, graduated college at 18.
What?
Yeah. Interned with two different powerhouse agencies, I think Trident and William Morris.
Wait, was she a talent agent? Because William Morris is huge for actors. Or was she literary section?
Literary side.
What?
And she is brilliant. And she's incredible. And like I say, we've been together for a super long time now, and I trust her with my entire career. But she was not my first agent. I did not do it right the first time. I made numerous mistakes along the way, and I was extremely impatient to be published. So you make the mistakes at one end or the other. You know, I just made a lot of mistakes early on.
Damn, that was so good. And by the way, I wasn't aware of Holly Root before, and now I need to talk to this woman because she sounds like one of those very rare, hard to find agents who really invest in you as human beings and not just as an object.
She invests in her authors for their entire careers. She helps them plan for their entire careers. Bless her. The fact that she puts up with me, I make this agent work so because I'm constantly, I believe in having 10 irons in the fire because 9 of them will fail, but I want to have one succeed. And like, bless her for never telling me no. She challenges me and she pushes back, but she's an agent who puts the author's career over the money. She puts the author's career over the now. She's just incredible. She's a diamond. She's a unicorn.
You both are perfect representations of our values here on the podcast and what our show is about. Just everything that you've talked about, how you talk about what you talk about, your transparency, and then how you also talk about your agent. It completely aligns with what this show is about. Like, I'm not even kidding. Not even kidding. So thank you for that. You are so amazing.
Of course.
Do you mind letting me squeeze in Kelsey's second part of her question? It'll be the last one of the listener questions, I swear to you. Yeah. Okay, so Kelsey, she'd love to know, along with Rachel Bishop, who's asking about world building advice, but Kelsey specifically was, do you character build or world build first?
I world build always first. For me, setting is a character. Setting is the very first character, and it's the foundation on which everything else is set. And that comes down to the fact that I write my outsiders as protagonists. And in order to write a strong outsider from a society, you really have to understand the insiders. And in order to understand the insiders, you have to understand the world that they fit so neatly inside. So for me, I broad stroke all of the world building before I write anybody into it. I populate the world after I design it. It's totally random, and it does not work for many people. But for me, it's essential to understand the rules of the world, because I guess for me, again, it's personal, but I don't understand how people can design characters that aren't part and parcel of the world that they're building. Because characters are, just like the rest of us, are the product of our environment. We do not exist in a void. And I think so often that can be why you get that little bit of separation feel when you're reading something where the characters seem to be floating on top of the world instead of part of it. I think that's when I usually suspect that the author has not grounded their characters in their environment, has not made sure that these people are believably products of their environment.
There we go. Dropping knowledge bombs. Clearly, it's like just so natural for you. All right. Well, Kelsey did finish up by saying that you've mastered writing multiple points of views so beautifully. And she wrote in capital letters, yay, with lots of whys. Aww. Can't wait to listen. She loves your book so, so, so much. So I just had to finish that part of her questions for you. Thank you so much for that. We're in 3 hours in. Holy moly. Thank you so much for all your time. Seriously. I'm going to wrap it up now. Let us know where, if there's any books that you recommend that listeners to check out that you love, that you want them to have in their lives and hold dear.
So there's a nonfiction book I want everyone to read at some point if they haven't. I'm not going to do a very good job of pitching it, so I just want you to just trust me. It's called Lab Girl. It is a nonfiction set of essays by a world-famous female botanist, I think. But she's assessing the world and mental health and identity and wrapping them all in these metaphors of what she studies through the natural world and through trees and this idea that trees, every seed for many trees can last up to 2,000 years and only gets to sprout once. And like it has to choose when it does that. And this notion of safety and doubt and challenge. And it's just like the most beautiful. I read it last year and it became the most impactful book I read all year. And I cannot fully articulate why. So I've just been asking people to trust me. Beautiful musings on the natural world and on psychology and on our place in the universe.
Wow. All right. Well, you sold it. You already pitched it very beautifully, of course, not surprisingly. We're going to pick up that book for sure. Look for it and let us know. Final question. Where can we find you on social media to say hi and thank you for an incredible 3 hours?
Come find me on Twitter. I'm just V.E. Schwab, V.E.S.C.H.W.A.B. And come say hi. And then same thing on Instagram. Come see my cat and my bookshelves.
And that wraps up our episode with the awesome Victoria V.E. Schwab. Victoria, thank you so much for your transparency. I had the best time talking about literally everything with you. And it was so much fun having you on the podcast. Storytellers, I hope you had so much fun listening in on Victoria's episode. I am so grateful for your support and thank you for hanging out with us every week. Please say hi to Victoria on Twitter at VE Schwab. Victoria recommended awesome resources for you to check out and we have them all linked up in her show notes page over at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Victoria Schwab. Calling all book lovers in our community. BookCon is the event where storytelling and pop culture collide. You get to experience the origin of the story in all its forms by interacting with the authors, publishers, celebrities, and creators of content that influence everything we read, hear, and see. We're talking about panels and Q&As with the authors, celebrities, and content creators. You'll get to stop by for autographing sessions, and there's also a show floor with the most influential publishers in the world. You'll see special guests including Kevin Hart, Bill Nye, yes, the science guy, Kristen Ritter, and Jason Reynolds, to name a few. You'll also see many of the amazing guests from 88 Cups of Tea like Matt De La Pena, Sarah J. Maas, RJ Palacio, Marie Lu, Cami Garcia, Leigh Bardugo, and many more. Check out thebookcon.com for more info. BookCon is the ultimate celebration of books where your favorite stories come to life, and it's all happening on June 3rd and June 4th at the Javits Center in my hometown in New York City. Head over to thebookcon.com to learn more. And don't forget to join our Facebook group if you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with other storytellers. You can also submit questions for future guests on our show, and we recently added live unboxing and book haul videos. So join me over in our private Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. There's tons of love, support, and encouragement going on in this special community of ours. I can't wait to meet you in there. Join us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. Have an amazing rest of your week, and I'll catch you in the next episode.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.